Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. We've been gone for a while on a summer break, but we're back here again talking about Egypt once again. A lot of things have popped over there since we were away. Jim, what's the layout of the land right now? What's the exact situation that's going on at the present time?
All right, there's two things going on, what we can see and what we can't see. What we can see is that the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a moderate Muslim radical group that does want Islam to conquer the world, wants all other religions to go away one way or the other, but it's not declared war on the world over the matter. But that is the main difference between them and Al-Qaeda. The Muslim Brotherhood is a kinder and gentler version coming out of the 1990s when the radical version took the Muslim Brotherhood into a terror campaign, much like Al-Qaeda does today, and was soundly defeated. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood was the only political opposition through decades of Mubarak's, in effect, dictatorship. And when Mubarak was taken down, there was no other political party. The Muslim Brotherhood was organized, and they did that because they operated out of mosques, functioning primarily as charities. Now, the government, the Mubarak government, allowed this because, the religion was important to a lot of people. And they knew that what the Muslim Brotherhood was doing, but they figured, hey, so what? You know, we control the army, we control the police, we control the economy. What can they do? Well, he turned out to be wrong in that point. However, when the elections were held, naturally, to no one's real surprise, no one familiar with Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood won. But at that point, their radical fringe, always the radical fringe, whether you're a Democrat, a Republican, or a Muslim Brotherhood, they said, look, we need Sharia, we need Islamic law in order to fight the corruption. And that's true. And indeed, a lot of Egyptians theoretically went along with using Sharia, and many of them not understanding exactly what Sharia meant or what the Muslim Brotherhood meant exactly by Sharia, because it was pitched to Egyptians as the cure for corruption, clean living, et cetera, et cetera. Your kids won't talk back and so on. But when they started to implement it, a lot of people got upset. They said, look, we don't want to change our lifestyle. We don't want to do things to scare off the tourists. You're like 15% of the GDP, or 15% of the jobs, about 10% of the GDP. In the meantime, they were doing nothing about the economy. So basically, people got angry at the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Muslim Brotherhood said, hey, we're doing the best we can. The military basically stood by. The police basically stayed out of action since Morsi got elected last year. Things were falling apart, and there were literally millions of Egyptians, in the streets earlier this year, basically not asking for the downfall of the Muslim Brotherhood, but they were asking for someone to fix the damn economy, which was bad enough when Mubarak fell 2 years ago, but it got worse after that. You got 90 million Egyptians, and most of them live paycheck to paycheck. So this is a serious matter. The Arab Gulf states, the oil-rich Gulf states, were not willing to subsidize Morsi. They didn't give him some money, but they weren't willing to prop him up with their money because basically they knew that Morsi was on the side of the Islamic radicals. So the army staged a coup, no other way to put it. And it was a coup by popular acclamation because when Morsi's supporters, came out to support Mr. Morsi, who is now a deposed president, they found no popular support. Whereas there were millions of people in the streets asking for Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood to be taken out of power, there were maybe 100,000 or so, Muslim Brotherhood supporters out there. when these people got stubborn, the army took a calculated risk, and they opened fire. And over 800 people have died, you know, since the 14th. At the moment, the Muslim Brotherhood is debating. Do we go back to the mosques? Do we get more radical? The smart money is saying, let's go back to the mosques. Let's rethink this. Obviously, you know, we lost the mandate of the people. But the radicals are saying, no, we have to fight. Now is the time. But unfortunately, most Egyptians, adult Egyptians, remember what happened in the 90s when the economy was trashed, a lot of civilians were killed, and for all that strum and drang, you know, nothing really changed. And the people turned on the Muslim Brotherhood in the 90s and put him down. In fact, the current head of Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, he was one of the, you know, the mid-level Muslim Brotherhood leaders who got out of Egypt alive and fled to Afghanistan in the 1990s. And there are many other senior Al-Qaeda people who belong to that group. So what's happening, what we can see is Muslim Brotherhood lost popular support and were deposed. They are still trying to disrupt the economy, which makes them even more unpopular. And the army is basically rounding up the usual suspects, you know, the leadership. They arrested the leader the other day, they're arresting the senior people. They're arresting everybody they get their hands on, and they're basically taking apart the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, what's happening that you cannot see is the fact that when Morsi got elected, he found out that the Mubarak-appointed bureaucracy was still there. There was no mass change of the government. When Mubarak was overthrown, the army, which is basically as corrupt as every other institution in the government, and most of the other government officials, again, except for the senior people who were tossed out, people who are identified as too close to the Mubarak family, most of them were still there. And they did not want this house cleaning to go any further, because not only would a lot of them lose their jobs, but the Brotherhood was talking about corruption prosecutions. And that's the wrong thing to say until you've cleared the house, as it were. Because all the people, we're talking about the judges, the senior, you know, bureaucrats who basically run, you know, the government, as it were, all the senior military people, they're all culpable. They could all go to jail. So they all kept their heads down. They said, yes, boss. You know, basically, the smartest thing the military did was when the crowds were out there demanding that Morsi, Mubarak be removed two years ago, first the police, they opened fire a few times, and then they sensed what was going on. The police are very corrupt. And they backed off. And it saved a lot of policemen from getting ripped apart by the angry mobs, as well as a lot of Egyptians not getting shot down in these squares. But then Mubarak turns to the generals, whom he supported, made a lot of them millionaires and very well off. He says, send in the troops. And the army, who, again, the generals are not stupid. They're corrupt, but they're not stupid. They know what goes on in the ranks. The officer corps, especially the senior officers, are corrupt, and they live off all sorts of wheeling and dealing. The Egyptian army has its fingers in a big chunk of the Egyptian economy. They want to keep that little, you know, scam going. But the lower ranks are more the people. Now, they're well taken care of in the army, but they have not forgotten where they come from. They're not getting rich in the army. They simply have a job. And the generals are in touch with the senior NCOs and other people who know what goes on in the barracks to realize that the troops will go so far, but they will not open fire on the friends they left at home when they, you know, after they join the army. They will not do that. If you do that, the senior NCOs told them, you're liable to have a rebellion, a mutiny. So the army, looking at where its interests lie, said to Mubarak, I'm sorry, we cannot step in, we cannot shoot down our brothers, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they probably had a form letter for that. And Mubarak at that point knew he was toast. His advisors also told him, now again, this will hopefully come out in the long run. He says, look, Hosni Mubarak. He says, take the fall, you know, keep your mouth shut, we can fix this. And they did, because Morsi, once he got elected, he found out the courts were ruling everything he did, including the parliamentary elections, as illegal. When they tried to nail the senior Mubarak officials for corruption and war crimes and you name it, they made no progress. The Mubarak Brotherhood realized the obvious that all these judges and court officials, they still work for Mubarak. And now he tried to change that. He tried to replace senior people in the army, but he found out that every officer down to, you know, lieutenant colonel or major, you know, considered themselves a Mubarak man. And they weren't about to rat out the boss. So the Muslim Brotherhood, I only mention this, what's going on behind the scenes, to point out that they will keep going. A lot of them will fight to the death because they understand and they believe what was going on, you know, outside the public purview. They realized that it was all those corrupt officials. And what the radical Muslim Brotherhood people are saying, and again, getting a lot of Brotherhood members, and there are several million, to go buy into this, he says, the only way we're going to fix Egypt is to kill them all. In other words, to have a real purge of the Egyptian bureaucracy, which means a lot of innocent people will be out on the street or worse, dead. What everybody fears is going to happen is that the righteous Muslim Brotherhood radicals are going to start a terror campaign, which is going to basically do what happened in 1990s. Now, they remember the 1990s. They say, look, you can't attack civilians. You got to concentrate on the military. But we know from Iraq and Afghanistan and any number of other places, Algeria, that doesn't really work. You start killing women and children. Basically the people have a vote, you know, a psychological vote, which expresses itself in, more civilians calling up the cops and telling them where the terrorists are hiding out, and bingo, you have game over. The big thing that, again, most people don't realize from the 1990s is cell phones have changed everything. This makes the radicals, it gives them a powerful tool, but at the same time, it means they have to maintain the support of the people. It's even more important because it's so damn easy just to slip into the shadows and get your cell out and call the cops and say blah, blah, blah. And 10 minutes later, you know, your local annoying terrorist is dead. That didn't happen in the past. So that's what's going on in Egypt. And it's only going to get more interesting, and not in a good way.
Austin, you wrote a very interesting column this week in your On Point column, and it talked about how Egyptians are not really Arabs, and Egyptians have this long history that precedes what came out of the Muslim history. Could you comment a little bit more on how that's playing out here in Egypt?
Well, let me respond to a couple of things that Jim said that they dovetail right into your question, an answer to your question, Dan. Jim pointed out that the bureaucracy and the judiciary were, he called them Mubarak supporters. They're out of the Nasserite nationalist movement, which military was the core of it. Because Nasser was a military officer, part of the young officers group that launched a coup now 60 years ago. And that's, you have Nasser, Sadat, Mubarak, and now al-Sisi out of that growing out of what was the nationalist, as expressed through the military, had roots in a movement called the Pharaonic, as in Pharaoh, that grew out of the 19th century. And that's just this nationalist Egyptian and Egyptian ethnic identity. And the history of Egypt, the long history of Egypt, was a source of pride. And it played a role in bringing together disparate groups within Egypt, whatever their religion, whatever their philosophy. We do share this rich legacy and heritage of ancient Egypt, and now forging a modern Egyptian state. Some of that movement, too, was resistance to the Anglo-Egypt, the British domination, because Egypt had essentially become a British satrap after being, in some respects, an Ottoman-Turkish satrap. Now, the judiciary and the bureaucracy that Jim was talking about, strongly influenced by that nationalist tradition, may be corrupt now as well, but they identify themselves as being, predominantly identifying themselves, as being Egyptians who happen to be Muslim, predominantly Muslim. And what was going on, it's not simply that they were crooked. The judiciary was looking at what the Muslim Brotherhood was doing in terms of solidifying control over all aspects of society. And when, as Jim pointed out, Morsi went for Islamization instead of economic reform or addressing the numerous significant social and economic problems that Egypt faces, in part because his belief is that if we are better Muslims, everything else will fall in line. Now, that is a selling point of the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamists throughout the world. The militant extremists, as in Al-Qaeda, which, as Jim pointed out, Al-Qaeda is rooted in the most extreme factions of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, is that this is an absolute article of faith, no pun intended. It's both literal belief and figurative belief. And that hasn't worked. Getting the religion right has not worked in fixing economies ever. That is as safe as a absolute statement as I could make. It has not happened. Even though you see some more successful tendencies with this in Turkey and its Islamist movement, they're something of what are called neoliberal or free enterprise, free market Muslims. Morsi wasn't that sophisticated. So some of the friction that he was encountering wasn't all based on corruption. It was based on, hey, wait a minute, you're taking us down a path that we've seen Iran take that path, and we don't have oil and gas exports to fall back on. We've got a food deficit right now, needing to import foodstuffs, and you're ramming a Sharia constitution down the throats of the Egyptian people. That occurs, Dan, November 2012, October, November, December, and that is when, in a previous podcast, the movement to say, hey, this Morsi is acting on behalf of the Muslim Brotherhood, not on behalf of Egypt, which comes back to answering your question. I already alluded to it. What is your identity? The Egyptian identity is, well, Nasser, the Egyptians predominantly, up until Nasser decided pan-Arabism served his broader political purposes, regarded themselves as Egyptians who happened to speak Arabic and were predominantly Sunni Muslim. I keep saying predominantly because there are reasonable indications that around 20% of the population was Coptic Christian in the 1950s, 1960s. That's shrunk. You see 15% now. I sometimes see 10%. In part, militant factions of the Muslim Brotherhood, what do, Dan, when a problem erupts? The militants go out and burn churches, predominantly Coptic churches, but they attacked. There's some Greek Orthodox and a few other Christian sects in Egypt as well, especially in the Cairo area, big cities, and they went after them. It's because part of their ideology is complete submission, and they're taking that as complete submission, complete subjugation. Now, The Egyptian identity is founded. They talk about, you'll run into Egyptians, and that was part of what my column was about. For what it's worth, I had a conversation with two Egyptian nationalists who happened to both be practicing, very committed Sunni Muslims. They saw themselves as Egyptians. And this was in last spring, and it was, we have the longest continuously recorded history of any people on the planet. And then, of course, the column devoted a couple of paragraphs to debating that. The scholars debate it, but the Egyptians can make the case because they're still around, and the Sumerian city-states aren't, and the Chinese and Indian civilizations, they aren't moving into where they're recording with a language system until perhaps 1,500 years after the Egyptians start. But the fact is, that's a claim they make with a great deal of pride. Just to comment on Jim's what Jim said, it also feeds into one of their most important industries, which is tourism. They've got all of those ruins and all of these museums, and it is hard currency, and they are great jobs. But in order to bring in the tourists from everywhere, not just Europe and North America, but from everywhere, they've got to have stability, and they've also got to at least project internationally that they're welcoming an international audience. And the Muslim Brotherhood failed at that miserably. You see, there's a real rational Egyptian economic interest on this. It's not just, hey, the crooked guys in the military or the... And that's, well, wait a second. You're scaring off what is one of our greatest assets, and you're even trying to erase it, which gets into the Muslim Brotherhood identity. As I've mentioned in the column, Muslim army that invaded Egypt, I think it was 642, with one of the, they'd had raiding parties coming in before that, but it completes the conquering of Egypt in 646 AD. And for the committed hardcore, and I didn't, not necessarily militants on this, but hardcore faithful in the Muslim Brotherhood, that's when significant Egyptian history begins. Because now we're Muslims. Our Muslims are in charge, and we're right with God, and this is our identity. You see the conflict right there with a substantial number of people, many of them Muslims, who are first see themselves as Egyptians. There are plenty of 21st century Egyptian nationalists who have no problems with being called Arabs. There is ethnic debate about it, but fine, we speak Arabic, and we are, the official name of Egypt is the Arab Republic of Egypt, Egyptian Arab Republic or the like. I mean, I won't go into the confusing United Arab Republic that Nasser created, but that was part of the, using the pan-Arabism as a political ideology to extend Nasser's influence and throughout the Middle East. But this is, all right, that's not a big issue. But they happen to be Egyptian Arabs. Our Arabs are Egyptians. And they're the heirs to this legacy that is extraordinary. I can agree with the claim of longest continuous recorded history. The thing is, but it's there's some reasons to argue that, their boast, as I call it in the column, is there's a legitimate boast. But the thing is, it certainly has influence in the way they see themselves as a nation, not just a collection of tribes. But it's one of the plagues of the Arab world, is it's tribal, not with the Egyptians. They've had a unified state. They had unified states when Europeans were worshiping trees, to use it as an example. And they see themselves as a national group. And a Muslim Brotherhood was, for ideological reasons, undermining that. The Muslim Brotherhood is an internationalist movement. Al-Sisi, in a interview with the Washington Post that ran, I think, is on the 3rd of August, because I went and checked it out, read it again before I wrote the column, told the Washington Post interviewer that there were representatives from over 60 nations with groups that are affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood that were showing up in Cairo. Morsi was interested in this. The implication was, and when I said implication, read through the interview, and you'll see this, is that Egypt was a base for creating a global caliphate, a significant base. Now, the connection there is Al-Qaeda translates in Arabic as the base, and you see here's another connection with the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. Ayman al-Zawahiri, al-Qaeda's current senior commander, joined the Muslim Brotherhood when he was 14. That's the common age. But within a year, he was in a militant extremist cell dedicated to toppling the Egyptian government. Because the Nasserites oppress us, our movement. Well, he was a Muslim internationalist, and the Egyptian government was in the way. Let's kill the military. Kill the bureaucrats, kill the judiciary, so we can use Egypt as a base for expanding, achieving a global caliphate. But to some degree, the nationalists and the internationalists and the Muslim Brotherhood, they've been fundamentally at odds. Fundamentally, there's another pun for you, Dan, from the beginning. And the coup simply once again exposes the ongoing civil war between them.
Well, interesting. Jim, where are we headed right now with all of this, with what's going on in Egypt?
The United States.
I know that's a big open-end question, but just where is that region headed? How is it going to affect things and the instability there in Egypt?
Well, the fundamental problem in Egypt, that is, the only politically organized group, aside from the ruling party, the dictatorship, as it were, is usually a radical, or in most cases, a moderate Muslim group. In other words, the mosques, the clergy, are the only people who were allowed under most of these dictatorships to have any political influence at the local level. And this is the same throughout the Islamic world. And what happens is if enough of these mosques become radical, then you have a terrorist network. Because the mosques are not absolute sanctuaries from police attack, but they do provide a, you know, moral authority and popular support that gives them some protection. So if a government loses the mosques, they have basically lost the people, lost control of the country. In Saudi Arabia and in many countries, the Muslim clergy are on the state payroll. They are government employees. That makes them a little more loyal. I mean, again, you can see what's going on here. There are various ways you can control the mosques. The senior people in Muslim countries, even including Saddam Hussein, pretended to be very devout Muslims. Now, it was BS, you know, it was easy to see through, but the public perception was, you know, parents could say to their kids, you know, see Saddam, he's a good Muslim, and not say anything else. but with no other experience with democracy or self-rule, you have an imbalance here throughout the Muslim world, which nobody's really, you know, found a so easy solution for. Because in all of the countries that were impacted by the Arab Spring, where the existing government was overthrown, there was nobody really able to replace it as a secular democracy, because you still had the mosques. This is a fundamental problem with Islamic societies. And there's no easy solution to this. Basically, the Islamic clergy have to agree, you know, in effect, among themselves, and this is more possible nowadays because with the internet, you know, these imams, they're literate, etc. They do get on the internet. They do speak to each other. But the problem you have within Islam is you have the radical fringe, which for over 1,000 years has been the voice, the often violent voice of conservatism, you know, to an extreme. In other words, when the Muslims, the talk about, and some Christians talk about, you know, how the European Renaissance in the 14th, 15th century was made possible by the wisdom of the ancients that the Arab scholars captured, you know, the Muslim scholars. Well, that was during a brief period in early, you know, the early history of Islam, where the Arab rulers, the caliphs, as it were, allowed scholarship to flourish and allowed basically the study of these pagan, you know, scriptures, these pagan texts, which were translated and preserved, in effect, by going into Arabic. A lot of the Arabic versions, there are no original source versions, but they were destroyed because there were so few of them. But eventually, after a few centuries, the conservatives came in and said, no, this is all haram, this is all forbidden. And that stopped. And that's why the Muslim world fell so far behind culturally, economically, politically, you name it. They just couldn't keep up with the West because they always had these religious conservatives who, if things started to get too modern, you know, too un-Islamic, the radicals would come out of the mosque and say, you know, we are on a mission from God. You must stop this forbidden practices. Now, they always accepted modern weapons, but a lot of, and of course, cell phones and what have you, but a lot of it they basically want to control. You can have cell phones, but you can't have access to the internet, or you can have the internet, but it's got to be an Islamic internet. You see where this has been going. Now, this should be no surprise to most people listening to this podcast, but this is a contradiction. This is a problem, a puzzle, and nobody's got a solution for it. So all of these post-Islamic Arab Spring problems you're seeing in every one of these countries is basically the locals running up against this problem. Now, the fix is underway, but again, if you look at history, which we as Strategy Phoenix do, you know, to solve problems now in the Arab world like corruption, like religious zealots and what have you, it takes time. In the past, it took decades, you know, centuries. In American history, remember, less than 190 years ago, there was a lot of corruption in the United States. The late 19th century, very corrupt. You know, a modern-day Iraqi would feel right at home, you know, in late 19th century United States because everything was for sale. And a reform movement arose, and over the course of maybe one decade if you're a fanatic, the corruption was largely tamed, not eliminated, but this disappeared from many, you know, areas of the United States, many phases of parts of the government and what have you, and culture and society. It's now making a comeback in the last several decades. I mean, it comes in waves. You know, it's up, it's down, it's up, it's down. But the practical thing is, if you want a thriving economy and a happy, you know, culture, as it were, where everybody gets most people get a fair shake, you need to curb the corruption. And most Arabs, most Muslims, they understand that. What they are working out is, how do we do it with this uniquely Muslim, you know, radical, you know, Muslims? Christianity never went through that. They were radical Christians, but they were never as strong as the radical Muslims. And that's an important difference. I mean, there are even radical, you know, Buddhists, you know, and every religion has its radicals. But Islam has the unfortunate distinction of having the most powerful radicals. And that's a real problem. But they'll eventually work its way through, but maybe not in the next decade. You know, it's going to take time. So I can't give you any prediction of quick success. At best, we'll get slow and steady.
Austin, let me make a comment.
How would you wrap this all up for us?
I want to pick up on a couple of things that Jim said. Now, it's not to wrap it up because, as he points out, this is a long process. Remember, Dan, in one of our earliest Arab Spring podcasts where we talked about the phenomena in general, I said, you know, this is going to take a long time. I think one of the first times I said This was 20 to 30 years. I know when I did a C-SPAN, I was on C-SPAN at a panel, and I said, I think at least 30 years, 30 to 40 years. There are a couple of things, and Egypt is to me, the most promising case for a number of reasons. One is that Jim, you know, was talking about how the Muslim Brotherhood was a government within a government. He didn't use that phrase, but that's a way to describe it, is that they were a resistance group operating beneath, especially when there was a banned movement, beneath the overlay of the Nasserite Egyptian government. They had political influence, and when Arab Spring occurred and they became an open, permitted political party, they had a leg up on everybody else. And Jim discussed that, and we discussed that in the past, too, about why it was very likely they were going to win the election. They were organized, and it takes organization to win elections, political elections, free and open elections, get your people out. The other elements of the revolution, whether they call them secular or nationalists and are modernizers, because remember, a lot of these people are Sunni Muslims, were separated by, I want to focus on these social issues, these economic issues. I want to focus on these issues. They were divided. Now, what has happened out of beginning in November and certainly expressed in the coup is what I argue. In fact, this is fodder for future discussion, but also an on-point call, is that you've seen a coalescing of secular nationalists, and I'll use them both together because all these people are not secular by any stretch. They've been very committed Muslims, coalescing into a common, more unified political movement, one that's capable of successfully winning elections in Egypt. Now, when is that going to become evident? 6 months? 6 days? 6 years? 20 years? Don't know, but you can see that happening. That's from the point of the modernizer that I am. That's good news. The other thing is that this informative element is the Muslim Brotherhood won. Look what Morsi did or didn't do. Look what he concentrated on. Part is, Jim says, the more rational elements, wiser, long-range leaders, still in the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, say, hey, wait a minute, let's not get violent, because then we'll lose whatever support we've got. We've alienated people, and because of what we did, let's learn from that. Let's go back to the mosque. So there's the those are the longer range issues. How they'll be resolved over time, we don't know. So that's the way I would wrap it up, okay?
Okay. Well, it sounds like Jim says it's going to be a long process, and we're going to be talking about this more. We'll be talking about the region more for sure. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Yeah.